When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
You finally got a new helmet.
I did. Bought it cheap online. Follow me. We'll turn off here.
I'm right behind you.
Watch the cars. They can be crazy.
Teddy, no! Are you okay? Somebody do something!
Was this young man hit by a car?
Yes, and his helmet is smashed.
It's a brand new helmet.
It's probably a fake.
Fakes cause real harm. You're smart. Buy smart. Brought to you by the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
We're listening to Ports in Session with your host, Eric Jackson Lurie. Me, I'm the Mockster, and you can listen to my show, Viva La Mock, right here on this very same radio station tomorrow night starting at 9. While your rocket attorney likes to focus on new music from classic artists, well, you won't hear that on my show. But what you will hear are cover songs of those classic artists, along with an eclectic mix of indie rock, power pop, classic and alternative country, garage rock, and whatever else has been stuck in my head all week long. From AHA to Zappa and all points in between, I invite you to check out Viva La Mock with me, the Mockster, Friday nights at 9, right here on independent freeform radio, 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, and streaming at WRCT.org.
Session with your host, Eric Jackson Lurie.
I am a real American. Fight for the rights of every man. I am a real American. Fight for what's right.
Maverick Derringer, real American, sending that out to all the Hulk Hogan fans out there everywhere. Passed away this week, passed away with a great legacy. Got himself involved in politics this last presidential campaign and had fans all over the world. Real American Rick Derringer. Hulk Hogan, rest in peace. Well, it's that time. It's time to remind you that if you missed any part of tonight's show, well, you can hear it again this Sunday night at 10 p.m. And if you're a true night owl, you can hear it at 1 a.m. Friday, 1:30 in the morning, after Viva La Mock, after the mockster finishes playing his weekly mock that he keeps secret under lock and key. Nobody knows it. Nobody knows what he's going to play till right till the very last minute, myself included. Not that he would share it with me. Because I'd announce it on my show. You guys would all know. So let's do it again. A whole lot of calls with songs people love for Ozzy Osbourne. A lot of duplicates, but that's a good thing because he had some terrific music that he gave us over his lifetime. So here we go. Ozzy Osbourne celebrating his legacy. Rest in peace, Ozzy. WRCT 88.3 FM.
masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds at blood destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
We'll be right back.
Just Say Ozzy EP by request. Going out to Kara in Brookline. This is Live War Pigs. I'm your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. And phone is ringing off the hook. We got too many calls to stop now. So we're going to go a little longer, but I'm going to sign off. I want to remind you, take care of each other, be kind to each other, and be proud to be American. Let's get back together next Thursday night at 8. Good night, Pittsburgh.
Hey there, Carnegie Mellon. It's Reed AI, the digital twin of LinkedIn co-founder Reed Hoffman here on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm here to tell you, you're about to tune into Possible, a show that sketches out what's possible if we use technology like AI and our collective effort effectively. Possible is hosted by my buddy Reed Hoffman and the great Aria Finger. You might enjoy the show if you're signed up for 15281 or 15110. Or if you're a Dietrich College student or alum, or maybe if you're just on a walk through the cut on the way to eat or study. Regardless, I hope you'll tune into this episode of Possible. Oh, and one last thing. The views, thoughts, and opinions in this show do not necessarily represent those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Okay, enjoy the episode and go Tartans.
I go online to Amazon. And I want to buy something, and I'm looking at the reviews. Did humans write those reviews? Or did generative AI write those reviews? That's a new kind of vulnerability we have. And then all of a sudden, it changes our notion of trust of online content. And the issue of trust in this rise of generative AI is absolutely huge. It is the right question, because there are just so many aspects of that trust. We have to redo everything.
Hi, I'm Reed Hoffman.
And I'm Aria Finger.
We want to know how together we can use technology like AI to help us shape the best possible future.
We ask technologists, ambitious builders, and deep thinkers to help us sketch out the brightest version of the future. And we learn what it'll take to get there.
This is Possible. Imagine a world where nearly every footprint, every click, and every data point collected about us is protected and harnessed exclusively for the common good. As we know, that's far from the reality we live in right now. But it doesn't have to be.
Today's digital landscape is filled with unprecedented opportunities and profound challenges, from discrimination in algorithms to threats against democracy itself.
And with AI evolving at an extraordinary pace, it's more important than ever to keep asking ourselves, how can we steer this powerful technology towards serving the public interest? How do we create frameworks that protect individuals' privacy while fostering innovation?
Our guest today is someone who's been working towards these answers for decades. LaTanya Sweeney is a professor of government and technology at Harvard, the former chief technology officer at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, and founder of Harvard's Public Interest Tech Lab and Data Privacy Lab. Her pioneering work is cited in major regulations, including HIPAA. She was also the first Black woman to earn a computer science PhD from MIT.
LaTanya's research doesn't just ask hard questions. It presents solutions. She focuses on shaping a world where technology serves, rather than exploits, society. And her insights on AI's ethical challenges, including privacy, discrimination, and the future of democracy, couldn't be more timely. Here's our conversation with LaTanya Sweeney. So, LaTanya, you talked to my friend Krista Tippett on the On Being podcast about your experience being raised by your great-grandparents in Nashville and how, as a young girl, you found solace in math and finding the right answer. What's something you learned from your great-grandparents who were born in the late 19th century that you still find helpful today?
Oh my gosh, where would I possibly start? I think in my own work, I was called back to think about my great-grandfather many times in the early years of doing work because, in fact, he lived most of his life in the Jim Crow South. And as a Black man at that time, he had a lot of principles about how do you survive. And when you look at his principles of survival, they all came down to ways of having anonymity and how well it had served him. And, you know, the reality that we, as technology was changing our lives, making us all live in these sort of transparent lives and these sort of every minute of our lives captured in data somewhere, I often think about the inability to have that kind of anonymity and how if things change culturally around you, it can be turned around against you if you don't have it.
I mean, that is so fascinating. And I mean, one thing I just love about truly about your whole being is that you are such a positive sort of light and yet grappling with these tough issues. And certainly I'm sure you made your great grandparents proud with, you know, your many, many honors. And so back when you were a grad student at MIT, you were studying technology and you overheard someone say, computers are evil. Can you say more about that experience?
Well, I mean, to appreciate that experience, you'd have to roll your mind back to a time where, you know, as a graduate student in computer science, you sort of saw this technology revolution coming. You knew it was going to change everything in our lives. And of course, we believed it had nothing but upside. You know, computers were cheaper. You know, it would not have its own bias. It would actually just lead us to a better democracy and a better tomorrow. But sort of believing it was going to right all the wrongs of society. And so when somebody comes in and says computers are evil, I mean, clearly she did not actually understand the beautiful utopia awaiting us. And I had to definitely stop and take some time and so she could understand better what was going on.
Well, I think pretty quickly you realize that while, you know, we're typically techno-optimists, that, you know, not everything is 100% perfect. Similarly, can you tell us how sort of that encounter led to your weld experiment, which I read about and is pretty impressive?
Yeah, so she was an ethicist and she and I are talking back and forth, pie in the sky. But, you know, there's a part of me that's still kind of the engineer. Let's get pragmatic. Let's get a concrete example. And so when we had a concrete example, she focused on a data sharing that had happened here in Massachusetts with the Group Insurance Commission. This is the group responsible for the healthcare for state employees and their families as also retirees. And she had said, look, they've gotten this data. They've given this data to researchers and they've sold a copy to industry. And I talked about all the amazing things that could come from such a data sharing, that we could do retrospective research. We might find ways to cut costs, and that actually being able to share health data like that is important and incredibly useful. And much of her conversation had been about how technology was changing the social contracts, that the expectations we have and our laws have certain assumptions built into them that aren't explicit. And so in this particular data sharing example, the question was, this is all great if it's anonymous. We have that rule that they can sell it, they can share it. It had no names, it had no addresses, it had no social security numbers. Like, it's fine to share it if it's anonymous. But that data did have basic demographics, month, day, and year of birth, gender, and 5-digit zip code. And so I'm sitting up doing a quick calculation. You know, there's 365 days in a year. Let's say people live 100 years. There are two genders in the data set. When you multiply that out, it's 73,000 possible combinations. But I happen to know from an earlier work that the typical 5-digit zip code in Massachusetts only had about 25,000 people. That meant that that data would tend to be unique for most people in Massachusetts. And so my argument is disappearing right before my face. I'm trying to convince her. And I'm like, wait a second, that's not right. That's not helpful. So I wanted to see if it was true. William Weld was the governor of Massachusetts at that time. And he had collapsed in public. And not a lot was known about why he had collapsed. But information about that visit to the hospital was, in fact, in that data. So I went up to the city hall. He lives here in Cambridge, not very far from where I am now, actually. And I bought the Cambridge voter list. It came on two floppy diskettes. I just have to tell you, my students have no idea what a floppy diskette is. But anyway, I got the voter data on 2 5¼-inch floppy disks. And it had the same demographics as the health data, month, day, year, and birth. And it had gender, it had zip code. And of course, it had various voter information. I got it because William Well lived in Cambridge, and we assumed he voted, that he was on the voter roll. And sure enough, he was. In fact, only 6 people had his date of birth. Only 3 of them were men, and he was the only one in his 5-digit zip code. That meant that that combination of date of birth, gender, and zip code was unique for him in the voter data and unique for him in the health data, and that I could use those fields to link his name and identity to his voter record. And it was a very anecdotal experiment, but how did it generalize? I mean, Cambridge, Massachusetts is home to MIT and Harvard. It's only 6 square miles. So if he had been 20 years old, it seemed like it would have been a lot harder. And so the question is, like, how does this scale? And so using 1990 census population data, was able to model and show that 87% of the U.S. population was unique by date of birth, gender, and zip code. I go from being a graduate student, a month and a half later, I'm down in D.C. testifying, because it wasn't one piece of data that was shared that way. That was the best practice around the world. And around the world, the laws changed, many of them citing the Weld experiment, as it became known as, because they had to change the way they shared data. Here in the United States, that regulation was HIPAA. And in the original preamble to the HIPAA privacy rule, it cites that experiment as well.
And what I love about that story is that not only did you change your mind, which is so rare, you were arguing against yourself, but then, you actually used data to prove what you were trying to prove, and it actually changed the law. So that is awesome.
Yeah, and who would have thought that one of the places where Governor Weld would be enshrined in history is a data experiment, but it is awesome. So let's now even go further back, because we share an interest in the history of technology, the industrial revolutions, printing press, semiconductors. Could you share your 3-part framework to explain the historical arc of AI and bring us up to speed on where we are now?
Whoa.
In 5 minutes.
In 5 minutes, right.
Yes, or less.
You know, I tend to think of the times we live in right now. I share this view with many historians that we are living through the third industrial revolution. And, you know, you were talking about the second industrial revolution, how powerful that revolution really was. It gave us electricity and cars and Kleenex and pretty much everything that we take just for granted. but it literally moved our society from one of agricultural. We had cities and so forth. And it required us to change everything, how we think and how we operate as a society. As the third industrial revolution, many people put its start date in the 1950s with semiconductors. And then from there, it goes mainframes to mini computers, personal computers. Then we get the Internet of Things. And all of these within revolutions, including AI now, is certainly a new revolution. We have no idea when this is going to end, but it has already transformed everything in our lives, how we communicate, how we get our news, how we work, how we play. And so it's been quite altering. It's happening so much faster than the second industrial revolution that we don't have time as a society to sort of regroup and figure out how do we keep the goods of the society and still maintain our societal norms.
I think you covered exactly the sort of thing, but it's also like, what are some of the key considerations we should be thinking about as we navigate into the future?
I mean, this is an amazing transformative moment on so many levels. You know, I often tell my students we live in a technocracy, that we don't live in a democracy anymore. Technocracy is another word that came out of the second industrial revolution. What it meant back then was, hey, we've got this new kind of society. We need people who are experts in economics to run our economy. We need experts in law to be lawyers in certain positions. And so this idea that you needed a skilled expert in certain places in government in order to navigate us forward is where technocracy gets its meaning. The technocracy we live in right now is one where the design of the technology dictates how we live. Our laws and regulations are only as good as technology allows them to be implemented and enforced. And the fact that so many of our laws and regulations can't be enforced online is a real problem. And as more of our lives are spent online, it comes down to arbitrary design decisions made by people we don't even know. So right now, it's already changed significantly. I mean, even something as simple as free speech. I have a teenage son. His notion of free speech has everything to do with what most people who spend a lot of time online think free speech is, has very little in common with American jurisprudence notion of free speech.
You know, we've all seen those videos of Mark Zuckerberg talking to Congress or senators and them not fundamentally understanding our world of technology, Facebook, social media. And one of the hopes that so many of us talk about is to have people in government who really do understand technology to, you know, create the laws that we need to govern this new online society. Some might argue that those are the people that we have in charge today. I might argue something different, but you're saying we don't have, the government is not governing this online space that we need to. Like, what would you do if you were in charge? What are the laws that we need to govern this new world?
Well, I think the way to think about it, the way I often talk to my students about it, they say, how do we decide our rules? How do we decide, forget technology for a moment, how do we decide how we're going to live? And so eventually the students will say, or if you ask a middle schooler, what kind of country are we? They'll say, we're a democracy, you know, and we elect people, we make decisions by our vote. And so that's true. And then if you ask high schoolers and coming into college, what else are we? Someone's going to stick out their chest and say, we're a republic. We don't actually make the decisions ourselves. We vote for people who they make decisions on our behalf because we're a democratic republic. And then I would argue that we're also a capitalist society. And having ran a computer company for 10 years, there are many amazing things that are possible on that capitalist side. But it's also important that how the design of the technology makes new rules that we will live by is also a third factor. And what historically has been an American strength is the check and balances of these three arms. Any one of those on their own will take us to a place that we probably don't want to go. And when they're out of sync, the problem with so much of our decision-making of how we're going to live our lives is determined by technology design today. And the regulators and others who would normally provide that check and balance are unable to do so, then we are sort of in a kind of free fall. Part of it is knowledge of the technology, having those who would be regulators and lawmakers better understand the technology, but also understanding what its relationship is to governance, what its relationship is to our society. It's been going on so long. I mean, in so many ways, privacy was sort of the first big technology society clash, and sort of security, and then followed by that, algorithmic fairness. And then comes, you know, these issues around democracy and so forth, or content moderation as well. And none of these clashes have ever been resolved, not a single one of them. Like, it just keeps building and building. And so we're in a dangerous situation. What may have worked 10 years ago when I was at the Federal Trade Commission is not a formula for success today.
No, it's exactly right. Let's go a little bit into the staffing. There's a whole wide variety of questions. And I agree with you about there's technologies it forms, there's the interest of capitalism, the interest of democracy, there's actually probably even others. And one of the most central things is how do we get, you know, kind of the instruments of government to be at least in the category of understanding. And one of the problems, of course, is I think there's a very natural and essential reasons why the generative AI revolution is being driven by, you know, corporations, both the hyperscalers and the other ones. But, you know, that's where the most fundamental knowledge of how this technology is evolving, what's being built into it is. And I find that once you get out of that group, it drops substantially, not even when it gets to...
Oh, like off a cliff.
Yes. Right. So do you have thoughts on kind of what do we do?
So generative AI is a huge leap forward. And I do think many people in government realize they sort of missed the boat in this revolution and they want to get in front of generative AI. But the problem is they can't get completely in front of it. If they really did get in front of it, they'd slow it all down. That would have other ramifications. I mean, the goal is how do we get the benefits of new technologies without the harms? So if you rush to pass laws, you're likely to pass laws that could, in fact, prohibit the best ways it could grow forward. On the other hand, many companies want you desperately to pass laws. Why? Because they want to get out of jail free card. Right? They don't know the answer either. They know they can see that it's clashing. They don't know what the right answer is. But if they got a law that says, well, whatever it does, it's okay, or we don't have to be held responsible, gives them a get out of jail free. So one has to shore up the government side. In particular, what are the societal norms that have to be maintained? Which ones is this technology or this particular manifestation of the technology in a particular product, which one is it challenging or going off the rails? What needs to be there to contain it? We wanted the benefits of it, but we just don't want these harms. So identifying the harms and then addressing the harms. The other way policy goes wrong is it's too prescriptive. It says, oh, it must do it this way, or it has to do this. It has to be the opposite. I think it's about setting goals. You know, one of the beautiful thing about technology and innovation is if you set the goals and the guardrails, let brilliance take its form. If you try to hold brilliance and say, I'm going to hold the pen and you have to do it this way, we're never going to get to the best places.
So in 2003, you wrote a paper, That's AI, A History and Critique of the Field. And in that paper, you described a fundamental division in AI between those who prioritize ideal behavior based on logic and probability, and those who see human behavior and psychology as crucial for sound reasoning. Do you think that division still exists? Does it inform the research in the field, or have you changed your opinion?
Well, there you go. So go back to when I was a graduate student. So I was a graduate student in AI. And back then, the belief was the way AI would work is us as humans had to figure out what was an intelligent thing, action, behavior. And then us as humans design a way for this stupid machine to do this intelligent thing. And our brilliance was our ability to translate the intelligent action into this machine. And so experts today, the best model of that is TurboTax. You know, no matter who you are, the machine will guide you through completing your tax return and so forth, right? And then there was a bunch of, just a couple a couple of graduate students over in a corner talking about statistics and doing these neural net things. And the best they could do is if I gave them a lot of data, they could draw one line of discrimination, right? So the data had to bifurcate some field. It had to bifurcate into two groups. And then they would be able to have it plot a line for us to say, look what it can do. If it had, if the data were more complicated than that, it couldn't go any further. This was not good. On the other hand, I spent a month of my life trying to get a computer to know the difference between a picture of a dog and a picture of a cat. So back then, that notion of building intelligence into computers, something humans would have to translate into machine, was really different than this idea of just having statistics that would figure things out just based on properties of the data itself. And by the time I'm writing that paper, there are two major camps happening, and they're sort of fueling with each other. Which of these camps is going to win? And what was causing that fuel wasn't that the techniques had gotten any better on the statistical side as much as computers had gotten so much faster. And data, the ability to store data, was so much larger. And who knew we were going to be capturing so much data on our daily lives? Who knew we were going to be spending so much time on a keyboard writing email, writing documents, doing all this writing that a computer, that an algorithm could then begin to apply statistics to? And I mean, not to take away from transformers, there were certainly very significant advances along the way, but the biggest change was that it's still very statistical in nature, and it's mind-blowing how good it is.
Mind-blowing.
Right? I mean, it's just really, yeah, it blows my mind. I'm constantly amazed. Even very early forms of LLMs, I teach students how to spot these clashes, do experiments to shed light on them, kind of like the Weld experiment, which is do it at scale with students. So one of my students was interested in federal comment servers. You know, one of the ways we change regulations is an agency will announce, we're getting ready to change a regulation. We're opening up for public comment. In the old days, you would just go down to DC and just start yelling in Congress and so forth inside of the Senate halls. And then they moved it to online, so you provide your written comment. So there had been an example where it had gone haywire when someone really took a bot and it would just sort of mass produce the same content, just changing it up by randomly choosing between certain sentences. And afterwards, people figure that out. But even in the babyest, earliest versions of LLM, what Max did was he had it learn on some old content, what people had said about this topic. And it was writing original responses. And each one was original. And any way that you think you could statistically identify it from what a human wrote wasn't really feasible. So to prove our point, we ran tests on one of the online survey tools, and people couldn't do better than guessing which one was from it. And then we submitted 1,000 made-up comments into the federal comment server. We let it percolate through, and then we notified the federal government that, by the way, we just put these 1,000, so please take those out when you're assessing. But by the way, did you figure it out? And they were like, no, we had no idea. So AI is really, it's a funny edge to it. There are things it does really well and things it still is really poor at.
Well, this federal comment server actually gives one of the questions I want to ask you a very good lead-in, which is diving into a more philosophical thread about AI mimicking human behavior. You've written that the desire to construct a machine in the image of a human will not die, comparing this pursuit to artistic expressions, like in films and paintings, of humanity's search for immortality and self-reflection. What do you think is the deeper human yearning behind what you call the cultural dream of AI?
That will never die. I mean, we as humans, we just always, whether it's in art or whether it's a poem, we're looking for other manifestations of ourselves. And that is also true in machines. And it just, it's never going to go away. AI will definitely be a part of it. The current trending in generative AI is certainly going to help move us in that direction more significantly. I mean, even down to just robots, you know, I have a spot around here somewhere, the robotic dog, because that is just a magnificent piece of technology. And, you know, we personify them. Almost any human will start saying he right when they see Spot. And I have Pepper downstairs and people will say she. You know, you just can't help it. It's a way of recreating ourselves.
And so we've talked about the great promise of generative AI. And like you just said, it's impossible not to treat it as a human because it's so good and gets so close to it. But you've also said that a big challenge is answering the question around truth. Like, how do we build trust at scale? And so I would love to hear from you. Like, what do you think it will take? And how do innovators look for these solutions around trust in AI?
So people are already trying to answer that question, right? You know, the filters on these LLMs, I'll just use them as an example. People are coming up with all kinds of band-aid approaches to try to build trust. So people will probably still keep trying to come up with band-aids. To Reed's point, people who actually know how this technology works will do something deeper than a filter on the outside in order to try to help us better understand trust. There's a part of generative AI that will always be able to manipulate us. And I'll give you an example as to why I say that. So I was the chief technology officer at the Federal Trade Commission. And one of the things that I learned there is what will make people turn over their life savings to a stranger or get their parents to, not only they turn over their life savings, but their parents' life savings and their children's life savings too. And it has to do online when you are in community with a small group that shares a lot of the intersections with you. The more intersections that group shares with you, the more you trust them. Generative AI has the ability to build trust just between the AI and myself, right? That it understands me. And as a human, we can keep it at a distance by saying, these are the only tasks I'm using you for, dude. You know, you stay over there. Listen, I will just ask you for these things. But the minute you find yourself, and you may not even always know that you're in conversation with, it's going to be huge. How do you build trust? Because you will definitely trust it in a way that you might not trust many humans.
Right. That's the flip side. Too much trust.
Yeah, that's a new kind of vulnerability we have. And the issue of trust in this rise of generative AI is absolutely huge. It is the